time for another episode of A Journey Through Stock Aitken Waterman. I'm Gavin Scott from chartbeats.com.au. Take a look around the site sometime, especially if you're a fan of 80s and 90s music, which I guess you are if you're listening to this podcast. Matthew Denby, you're a fan of 80s and 90s music, aren't you?
Well, the good 80s and 90s, Gavin. So no Dire Straits or Michael Bolton, and definitely no Four Non-Blondes, please.
Oh, I would agree with all of that, except How Can We Be Lovers by Michael Bolton is a classic, but...
Well, you've just turned off all of our listeners by saying that.
We're not here to talk about power ballads, are we, Matt?
No, thank God.
What we are here to talk about are the next four songs produced by Stock Aitken Waterman in 1986. And this episode, we've got lots of newcomers, people we haven't talked about before, people we haven't talked to before, lots of interviews to come as well, and a familiar group who we'll get to at the end. But we're going to kick off with Phil Fearon and his single, I Can Prove It. Now, Phil Fearon was another one of those established artists who came to Stock Aitken Waterman having already had some success. He was the front man for a group called Galaxy, and he came to Saw for a little bit of help with his latest single, which was a cover of I Can Prove It. Let's have a little bit of a listen. I Can Prove It There by Phil Fearon, released in mid-1986. It got to number 8 on the UK chart. Quite a success for Saw at this stage, given a lot of their songs weren't charting at all, as we'll see. Matt, what do you think of I Can Prove It?
Yeah, Smooth as Silk. That's a really good example of some mid-80s soul pop at its finest. Really, really enjoyed that, actually.
Yeah, it's Saw back doing the soul pop thing and doing it really well, and obviously doing it with an artist who already did it really well himself. Now, as I mentioned, Phil Fearon was the frontman for Galaxy. He'd had three previous top 10 hits, the biggest of which was Dancing Tight. Let's hear that now. That was Phil Fearon's biggest hit before coming to Saw, Dancing Tight, which got to number 4 in the UK. It's kind of a little bit confusing exactly what was going on with Galaxy and Phil Fearon. His earliest releases, they were just credited to Galaxy. Then it became Galaxy featuring Phil Fearon. Then it became Phil Fearon and Galaxy. And I Can Prove It was just released under Phil Fearon. So was it his first solo single? Not quite. We spoke to Phil and he explained everything. I understand that you are essentially, or you were essentially Galaxy.
Yeah.
And you had the female vocals as well, but it was essentially you. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, it was like a one-man band, really. In fact, the concept of the Galaxy, when I first brought the demos in, I did not intend to be the artist, right? I wanted to be sort of some backroom Svengali pulling strings and writing and having basically, I wanted about 4 or 5 white guys to go out there and be the band. And I was going to be in the background writing and producing and not really being the artist. Like I was trying to create my own Beatles, you know? That's why it was called Galaxy. Initially, it wasn't called my name because I wanted to create a faceless name. The guys at Ensign said, well, who's the guy on the demos? I said, well, I'm on the demos. They go, well, you're the artist then. So I quickly changed. I didn't intend to be the front man. And later on, people were trying to work out who is Galaxy, what are they? And then it said it became Phil Fearon and Galaxy. The backing singers were effectively a bunch of girls who were doing great harmonies in their own time. And I was looking for some backing singers. And a guitarist friend of mine said, I know some girls who do some backing singers. There's 4 of them. And they used to come around and do demos with me. I used to call them obscene hours of the night. So I need some backing vocals. And they'd come down. I used to borrow petrol money off them because that's how broke I was at the time. And eventually, 2 of them dropped out. And the other 2, Julie and Dee, they said, this day. And then when we got the deal, I said, look, guys, we're doing Top of the Pop soon. Who wants to be involved? Yes, please. Then the look of Galaxy became me and the 2 girls.
And you went on to marry one of them.
Indeed. Yeah, it's quite efficient.
Well, that clears that up then.
Yeah, it does. I've always wondered why the credits kept changing, whether it was kind of like a Diana Ross thing or a Gloria Estefan thing where they kind of outgrew the band they came from. But in this case, Phil Fearon essentially was Galaxy. Now, this song, I Can Prove It, as I mentioned, was a cover version of a track by Tony Ottoria, which had reached number 21 in the UK in 1977. Let's hear that original version. If you just let me try. I have to say, I think Phil did a better job on this. What about you, Matt?
I think they're both good records, but they're both from very different eras, aren't they? I mean, Tony's is so disco. It's got all the little disco notes all the way through it. And then when we come to the mid-80s, some of those have been strategically removed and it's been updated into something that was very much of its time. It's a very 80s, in a good way, of course. And I think that both versions stand on their own two feet. They're both good.
I really like the Phil version. I think it was deservedly a hit. But the interesting thing is, not only was it a cover version when Phil Fearon had been writing his own stuff for years, but he'd also been producing his own stuff for years. So the question was, why did he come to Stock Aitken Waterman? Because he could have done it all himself. What prompted you to remake I Can Prove It?
You know something? That was once again a good idea from the label, because the record label were asking for months and months to do a remake of Tony Iommi's I Can Prove It, which I love the original when it first came out. I love the record back in the day. But I didn't want to do it because sometimes I think, don't mess around with other people's tunes unless you know it's going to be really, really done well. And I wasn't really confident, but they insisted it'll be a big hit. And I kept resisting it. And this is one thing I just wasn't confident with going with. And my brother, a kid brother, was part of another local band called Northwest 10. Strange enough, it was my kid brother who became my missus's kid brother and another friend, three younger guys. And the label Ensign convinced them, because they were working with Ensign for a little while as well, convinced them to make the remake. And they'd done a really good job. But Ensign said it wasn't quite right yet. And they asked me to take their version that they'd done and really sort of Phil Fearonize it a bit. So reluctantly, I went in, took tapes, change around a few things on, you know, the bass line and a few odds and sods here and there. I tweaked it a bit and they said, that's going to be a hit. It just needs one more thing, a mix by Stock Aitken Waterman. So they took the tape to Stock Aitken Waterman, and Mike Stock, who's a complete genius, unbelievable. The way he works in studios is quite magical. He said, you have to redo the lead. So I went in the studio, re-sang the lead. I spent about, I don't know how long, and right at the last sort of 30 seconds, I sort of changed my approach and he goes, right, back to the beginning. We're doing it all again now in that approach. So it took a while to get the way he wanted. And then he added some little bits of colours here and there. And he really did add the fairy dust to make it what it became. He put little touches, really small touches, but they were just genius. So ever grateful for that.
Being a writer and producer yourself, was that the resistance to doing a cover? Oh, I don't want to sing another person's song. Was that part of it as well?
Not really. I just wasn't sure if I was going to get it right. I wasn't sure if it's going to be right for me. And also, I've got so many ideas of my own and that I wanted to bring through. But I was wrong. I mean, the way it turned out, I look back and I think I'm so glad they pushed that forward.
How did your brother feel about you having the hit with the song that he and his group had recorded?
Well, they were cool with it because, I mean, I don't think Ensign were going to put it out with them anyway. So they weren't actually going to use it. So he was going to sit on the shelf and gather dust. So, you know, it worked out good.
And then the decision to get Saw to do a mix, or it sounds like additional recording and then a remix as well. Were you familiar with them before that?
Yes, I'd been in their studio for a few other bits and pieces, nothing related to me, just accompanied my manager in there for a couple of meetings, but I can't remember what exactly it was. And we used to bump into Mel and Kim every now and then. So we sort of, we crossed paths every now and then, but we weren't really working as such. And there wasn't any plan that I Can Prove It was the first real connection. But there was other events now and then where we crossed paths with Pete Waterman and, you know, sit down and discuss sports cars or something like that, you know, not non-musical, you know. So there was, but the first actual musical venture was that one.
And what did you think of their previous stuff?
Personally, I absolutely loved it. You know, of course, they had a formula. And, you know, people like to beat up people with formulas. But for as far, I love the stuff. I mean, I just thought it was very, very clever. It just simple. It was what it was. It was pop cleverness. They really made some great records. Princess, that record is amazing. And I remember when the amazing Rick Astley tune came out, I remember a bunch of my sort of colleagues dragged me in the studio and said, this is the kind of music you should be making now. Because it was just so well put together. It was just such a beautiful tune. I was definitely a fan of what they were doing. I knew it wasn't, at that point, it wasn't trying to be the coolest soul dude. They weren't doing that. But they are so clever. If they wanted to, if that's the kind of music they want to make, they could have made it as well. They could make any kind of music. But they realized that for the UK, what they were trying to do, this is their scene. and it was highly successful. And I'm kind of glad to be part of it.
When you said Mike did his little fairy dust on it, what kind of stuff are you talking about? Obviously, you've talked about the vocal. You redid the vocal.
Largely, he used the recording as I recorded it, basically. And he had to redo the lead. But the most noticeable thing he done is just that when it starts off, girl, I can prove it. Ding, 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 ding. That little echo of the main melody. Just that alone that made the melody come out a lot stronger. And when he done it, I thought, why didn't I think of that? You know, but he knew what he was doing. I was very happy with it.
Okay, thanks, Phil. So yeah, this has been one of those tracks where there's always been a bit of controversy over, is this a Stock Aitken and Waterman record? And what does make a Stock Aitken and Waterman record when there are other sort of production voices and other people involved in getting it out there? So this does make it a little clearer. Of course, we're going to encounter that question again a few times in the near future with people like Pepsi and Shirley. But with Phil, we now have a better idea of what's going on.
Yeah, it was really interesting to get a definitive answer on this, because if you look at the credits, it says Phil Fearon, producer, and Stock Aitken Waterman and Phil Harding are credited with post-production and mix. And, you know, what does that mean? Because we made a distinction, didn't we, Matt, that we weren't going to just talk about the remixes that Saw did.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think this qualifies as a bona fide production. Yes, obviously Phil did the groundwork and then Saw came in and, you know, took it to that next level. And Phil is the first to say how happy he was with the result.
It's a good record and the chart position says it all. I think everyone should have been happy with the way this one turned out.
Exactly. And as we'll see in a few episodes' time, it led to Phil and Stock Aitken and Waterman working together on another record. Now, from one male singer with a hit track record who came to work with Stock Aitken and Waterman, we move now to another. But things didn't go quite so well this time, did they, Matt?
Well, maybe not in terms of chart positions, but this song is actually really well regarded anyway. This is very much a foreshadowing of the kind of joyful, upbeat pop that would soon become Saw's defining sound. And as you say, this one features an established face who'd already fronted two major chart hits as a member of the band Tight Fit. Singer Steve Grant was now one third of the new group Splash. They were what we'd probably call these days a boy band, and they were signed to Elton John's Rocket Records. Their debut single was a Saw composition, Qu'est-ce que c'est? Let's give it a listen. That was Qu'est-ce que c'est by Splash, released in August of 86. Now, despite having the advantage of featuring an established pop star and having the backing of Elton John, that one unfortunately didn't get any traction at all on the charts. What did you think of it, Gavin?
Well, first of all, I think it's quite shocking that it didn't even crack the top 100. But I really like this song. This was, again, you know, same old story. I didn't come across it in the 80s, picked it up in the 90s, got the 12-inch of it, and I've always really liked it. I liked it so much that I cut my own 7-inch version of it. The 12-inch I bought didn't have a 7-inch version, so I had to, rip it onto computer and make my own version, all that kind of thing in the world before YouTube. It's really upbeat. It's, as you said, really euphoric, really, energetic. But Tight Fit weren't a band I was that familiar with. I knew The Lion Sleeps Tonight, but in the UK, they were really quite successful, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right. The Lion Sleeps Tonight was actually a really iconic, huge hit. Then, of course, they followed it up with Fantasy Island with Steve and the two girls in the band actually got to sing on this record. They were hired to front The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which was actually recorded with a bunch of session musos. So they were now a legit band and they came out with a follow-up single that was very ABBA-esque, and I actually find it incredibly shocking that that song was never, ever covered by Steps. Should we give it a listen, Gavin?
There's actually a Saw connection in Tight Fit, isn't there, besides the fact that Steve went on to record with Saw? What's the other connection, Matt?
Yeah, well, one of the girls in the band, Denise Gingell, went on to marry Pete Waterman, so she actually became a part of the family, really, yeah.
That's right. Now, enough about Tight Fit. Let's talk about Splash. And the story of Splash is really interesting. It's not a band I knew anything about whatsoever, and it sounds like it was really a case of right place, right time for Steve. Shall we listen to him tell the story?
Yes, let's do it.
A friend of mine was doing a demo at PWL for a track, and she asked me if I would go with her to the studio for some support. So I went along, and I was waiting for her while she was doing her vocals, and I met a guy who was managing a band called Splash. He kind of explained that there had been five members, three members had left, and they were looking for somebody to do lead on the track. So we got chatting, and he said, "Would you be interested?" And I said, "Sure, I'd love to hear the track." He played it to me, sounded really good, and I went in the studio at PWL and just did like a verse of it because the record company wanted to hear what I sounded like on this track. So I just sang a little bit of it. And that was all fine. It went fine. And then so I signed a deal with the label after the others had already been in that group and had the record deal. So I was kind of a latecomer to that, to the group. Yeah. And Stockcake and Waterman had the song kind of half written. They had bits of it written. I seem to remember when we went in the studio, they were still writing it as I was singing it. It kind of just went from there, really.
So Splash at that stage, was it Stephen Whitfield and Chris Brennan who were the two left standing?
That's right, exactly. Yeah. Stephen and Chris. Stephen had been quite famous in London for doing a drag act where he was Marilyn Monroe. He was a brilliant, absolutely brilliant Marilyn Monroe. He was very pretty, blonde guy. Sadly passed away a few years ago. And Chris, who is still a friend of mine, he lives in Spain.
And did they welcome you with open arms, or was there a bit of a getting to know each other?
I think because we didn't know each other at the time, maybe they were a little bit wary of me. But we soon settled in. And yeah, no, it was, I can remember feeling a little bit uncomfortable at first, just because I was the new guy and they were kind of established in the band. But that kind of soon passed. It was very, very brief, and we got on absolutely fine.
And you did lead on the track.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah. So it was one of those tracks, like I said, they were writing it as they went along. They had the chorus idea for it, and I worked mainly with Matt Aitken doing the vocals. Who was lovely, really, really sweet guy. Yeah, I just went in one evening and we got the vocals down, and then kind of a month later we did the video for it. I'm not sure that I ever met Mike Stock, because when they mixed it together, probably I wouldn't have been there. When we did the video for the song, Pete came down and is in the video.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. He's the guy in the back when we're on stage. He's like playing drums in the background. Because he loves being on camera. So the opportunity to get on stage, he's there. And I can remember chatting to him on the day, and he was, because it was quite in the early days of PWL, and he was telling me all about that he'd just signed this great guy, had a lovely voice. He thought they were going to have massive hits with it, called a guy called Rick Astley, who obviously went on to be a massive star. But they, like I said, it was the early days, and they'd only just signed him and just done the one single. And yeah, so we did the video, and then after that, yeah, the song came out.
And it was with Rocket Records, right?
Yeah, yes, that's right, with Elton, is Elton's label, who was really nice to us, very supportive. And we had a fantastic night, because we all three of us got an invite to Elton's 40th birthday party at his then manager's house. They sent us a limousine, and all the stars were there, and any star, you name them, they were all there. So probably that was one of the highlights of being part of Splash, was going to that party that night.
Did it feel like Splash was going to take off? Because obviously you had PWL behind you, you had Elton behind you, you kind of had everything going in your corner. Did it feel like this could be big?
No, because you never know with a track, and no matter how good it is, or whether you've got people behind you or not, it doesn't matter. And at that time, if Radio 1 had played your track, they had all the power. And if they didn't pay it, you were going to struggle with it. Yeah, the single, like I said, wasn't was going to say to you, the single wasn't a massive hit, but I'm still proud of that single, and it was a good experience. But Qu'est-ce que c'est was a good track, and I think it should have been a bigger hit than it was. We toured with it. We did gigs all over the country promoting it, but it just wasn't. It was one of those tracks that BWL had lots of hits, but sadly that wasn't one of their big ones.
And what did you think of the song?
I liked it. I thought it was a really good track. I used to go clubbing in my youth in those days, and if I would go out and hear it come on in a club, people would all dance to it and get up and dance to it. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. I was proud of it. One of the issues, I think, with the track at that time was the DJ responses were that it was too fast. So a lot of DJs used to slow it down a little bit because I think it was about 140 BPM, which at that time was probably a little bit faster than what other tracks they were playing.
You know, Steve is right. It is a very fast song, isn't it, Matt?
It is, but I think that's a good thing. You should know that about me, judging from some of my personal tastes. I think it's an early example of Saw taking some of the power, the driving power of High Energy, and applying it to a very accessible pop song. It's got a fast beat, but to me, it's way more pop than it is clubby. It's certainly not a hard club record like Dead or Alive, but it's got some great moments. I really do enjoy it. I actually have a moment in it that's one of my favorites that's quite rare for a Saw record. There's a really distinct crescendo where there are female backing vocalists come in. It's just really ecstatic. Can we listen to that now, Gavin?
Sure. So there we go, Stock Aitken & Waterman putting the high in High Energy. Another thing we need to talk about, and it kind of ties in with the speed and the kind of freneticism of Qu'est-ce que c'est, is the manic dancing in the video. Those Splash Boys were busting some moves, weren't they?
They certainly were. They were high on a happy vibe, weren't they?
Yeah, okay. Let's hear from Steve about the music video, and he talks as well about the follow-up to Qu'est-ce que c'est. Here's more from Steve.
The record company spent quite a lot of money on it. We went to this club in London just off Putney High Street, I can remember very clearly, and we had lots of dancers, some very good dancers. One of the girls actually was Bunty, one of the girl dancers, was also the girl who'd been in the Aha video for that time when videos were, people were spending 10,000-20,000 on a video for a track. It was kind of, yeah, it was good. I thought it was a good video.
Was the choice of clothing deliberate, a point of difference to have you all, you know, suited up?
I think it was probably the record company's idea. Yeah, and I was really happy not to be naked because people had enough, I think, of seeing me like that. So I think the suits were kind of to get away from anything that I'd done in the past and also to give us an identity. So pink suits were the order of the day for that track. Like three gay guys in pink suits. Yeah, great idea.
It's interesting you mention three gay guys. There's a female love interest in the video.
I know. And in fact, the record company were very worried about Stephen because he'd been very well known for being a drag star in London and doing Marilyn. And they didn't want that to come out at all. Really, really didn't want that to come out. So I think it was just playing the game like everybody did at that time. You know, it was very difficult to be out and to be who you really were. They didn't want us to be known as a three gay boy band. That was something I think that was a little bit difficult in the video to watch that now. I think perhaps it would be done quite differently in this day and age than it was back then. Times were very different.
You then did go on to work with Bronski Beat, who are obviously the exception to the rule on that front because they were very out.
Yeah, exactly. And the song, in fact, European Boy, they actually changed the lyrics a little bit for us because the lyrics were quite, the lyric and part of the track, I can't remember what it was now, but they got them to change it because they thought the lyric was too gay. These three guys who were in pink suits. Yeah, I mean, they were very sweet, Steve and Larry. I loved working with them. Really lovely guys. European Boy was a good track. I thought it was a nice song, but Again, it didn't really take off. Although I still got people messaging me about that song now and saying how much they enjoyed it. So, yeah, it's another track that I've done. I'm quite proud of that song.
Looking back now, why do you think Splash didn't take off? Why do you think those two songs didn't connect? I mean, there's the Radio 1 thing that you mentioned. Do you think there was anything else that worked against the band?
I think it was mainly radio. We didn't get the radio support that we could have done. I think that was the primary issue. I can remember when Dead or Alive had their hit with Thin Me Round, that song wasn't played on Radio 1 at all. They wouldn't play it, but it was a massive hit in the clubs. And Radio 1 then had to change their minds and they were forced to play it because it had been such a big club hit. And ours wasn't as big as that song. You know, it wasn't as big in the clubs as that track was. So I think it was partly just because the track was okay. It wasn't brilliant. It was a good track, but it wasn't up there with the likes of Dead or Alive or those kind of songs that PWL had put out. I think it could have been a hit if it had a bit more support, a bit more radio support, a bit more radio play, but that didn't happen.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So if you think back to the mid-80s, it was quite hard to be a gay artist in many ways. There were either people who were very, very out as part of their personas, like Bronski Beat, or there were people who were just simply not allowed to be out at all if they were pitched at, say, what was perceived to be a female audience. They wanted to be seen as being obtainable to the audience, I guess. So a lot of artists were forced against their will or against their wishes to either be quiet or to actively lie about their sexualities.
And it's interesting, you say the mid-80s, but it was also going on in the late 80s as well, because Splash really were a precursor to Big Fun, weren't they? Three gay guys dancing around pretending to be interested in girls.
The big difference is obviously that Steve actually has a good voice.
Is this where I say something about serving tea or shade or something like that? Anyway, we're not that kind of podcast. These days, Steve and the two ladies in Tight Fit, Denise and
Julie Harris.
Thank you, Matt. Have reformed. They've been back together since 2008 and they actually have a new single due out very soon. Now, unfortunately, Qu'est-ce que c'est didn't chart at all in the UK and neither did the next song produced by Saw to be released in 1986. That was Second Time Around by Jeb Million, a new name to the podcast, and another song produced by Saw that didn't chart. What do you think of this song, Matt?
Yeah, this is a real anomaly. I wonder when it was actually recorded because it kind of harks back to the era when Saw were doing records with acts like Spelt Like This, when they were taking on lucrative money deals with record labels to produce artists who wrote their own songs. This was presumably around the same time. It'd be interesting to know. If you came in uninformed and you didn't know anything about this record at all, I think you'd struggle to immediately identify it as a Saw record. The songwriting's really clearly not their songwriting. The structuring of the song is quite different to what they usually do. And even the production is a bit indistinctive in that there's not many moments that really sort of push buttons and immediately trigger you to think that's Saw. There's some really good vocals here. I think he's a great singer. There's some vocal gymnastics that you don't usually hear on any Saw records. And I think that's probably because Jeb wrote it and he had the confidence and the room to move in terms of expressing himself vocally with his own record.
Yes, agreed. Now let's talk a little bit more about Jeb. Jeb Million, it's not his real name. He was born Jerry Milne. He was a Canadian singer, and I say was because he passed away in 2013 at the age of 59 from a heart attack. He had been in a band called Fury that changed its name to Blazer Blazer and then he was in another band called Jeb Million and the Broadway Brats. But by 1986, or as you said, Matt, whenever this was recorded, he was signed to WEA, so major label, and he came to work with Stock Aitken Waterman, and second time around was the first of two singles that he recorded with them, and they are very much a forgotten part of the Saw story. You never hear people talking about Jeb Million. They did pop up in that Say I'm Your Number One Saw box set, which is how I have them on CD. But other than that, they have been brushed under the carpet, haven't they?
Yeah, but if you go online and look on the comments on YouTube and other places where this song pops up, he does have quite a devoted little following. People really know a lot about him. They really remember him. They're quite appreciative of the legacy that he did leave behind. So that's nice to know that he did make a mark. And these songs are good songs, I think.
I prefer the second one, which we'll get to in a few episodes' time, but I don't mind this one. Let's get a little bit more insight now to this record from Mike Stock. Here's Mike talking about working with Jeb.
Very talented songwriter, very good voice, actually. He's one of the guys that was a musician as well. And so we had to accommodate his ideas, and we did. He did like what we were doing. We were going somewhere with him. Whether we actually really nailed it, I don't know, because it's a quite different form of pop or music than what we were just talking about. There's no, you know, Eurobeat influence in that. But it's so, like, it's just our eclectic taste. This was a bit more, trying to think of the example, really. Come up with the name of the band in a minute. Yeah, Scritti Politti.
Okay.
Do you remember them?
Love Scritti Politti.
Yeah, that's the sort of area he wanted and we thought was good for him. He was very emotional, and he was in tears a couple of times in the studio. And I think he was fighting the demons.
I thought Second Time Around sounded a little bit like something Jason might have performed in a couple of years' time.
Yeah. quite a good, difficult vocal, that, I have to say. Jeb has a good range. It's not sort of range Jason has.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear Mike say that Scritti Politti was an influence here. Now, the last time we heard that band mentioned was in relation to Brilliant's It's a Man's, Man's, Man's World, when the similarity to songs like The Word Girl were very clear, that kind of reggae pop sound. But in this case, I wouldn't have picked it myself. But now Mike has mentioned it. Some of the instrumentation in Second Time Around, some of the backing vocals do remind me a little bit of Scritti Politti. I have to say the backing vocals in Second Time Around are a little bit weird. I find them a little bit off-putting. Let's hear a little bit of a song called Perfect Way by Scritti Politti, which was very big in America. It's probably the one that is maybe closest to Second Time Around. Let's have a quick listen.
You know, one of the influences that I see here is a bit of 50s rocker. There's sort of a bit of a North American twang all the way through it as well. So I think being Canadian, Jeb's brought some of his influences over, and they sort of survived being produced by Saw and gave these records their own real identity.
Two flop singles in a row for Saw. Surely the follow-up to an international chart topper would provide them with another hit. Right, Matt?
Well, you would think so. Now it's time for Bananarama's follow-up to their global smash Venus. That track had been top 10 in the UK and a huge number one in many countries, including both the US and Australia, and the pressure was really on to follow it up. The next single from the True Confessions album was More Than Physical, the band's first ever co-write with Saw. The track had been re-recorded for single release from the album version with brand new vocals, a beefed up production, and a bunch of throbbing mixes aimed straight at the dance floor. Let's give it a listen. That was More Than Physical, which came out in August 86. Unfortunately, it fell well short of the commercial success of Venus, hitting 41 in the UK, 73 in the US, 38 in Germany, 25 in Ireland, and 28 in Australia, despite Venus having been number one in Oz for 7 weeks. Well, that's certainly a letdown. What do you think, Gavin?
Yeah, I was really surprised that this wasn't more successful. I mean, number 28 in Australia was not too bad, top 30 hit, but only reaching number 41, the dreaded number 41 in the UK, I find really surprising given Bananarama's track record and the fact that Venus was quite successful. I don't know why it wasn't a bigger hit, but thank goodness they did remix it from the album version. Can we have a listen to the album version?
Yeah, let's do it.
I can't disguise it. I'm so excited. Doesn't really sound that excited to me.
Well, thank God they did re-record it because the single does have a lot of energy behind it and I actually really enjoy it. It's a really good down and dirty club record, but as a follow-up to a hit of The Scale of Venus, it just doesn't cut it. Despite really liking it at the time, I distinctly remember being really disappointed because I just knew it wasn't going to be a major hit. After Venus in Australia, I can tell you it really seemed like Bananarama had a shot at the A-list. Like if they came up with something else as good as that, they could be up there with people like Madonna or Prince, that sort of A-list pop star. Unfortunately, they just couldn't sustain it with this single. It wasn't, you know, as accessible enough. It wasn't radio enough. It's certainly a favorite amongst Bananarama fans, and it's a favorite on the dance floor in clubs. But unfortunately, it wasn't the hit they were looking for.
It does feel like they gave it their best shot with this. They thankfully made a really great single version that drastically improved the album version. And there were stacks and stacks of remixes made for the clubs. Actually, let's listen to a couple of them now. We've got the Garage Mix and a mix by Ian Levine as well. So let's hear them right now.
Yeah, great stuff. They're both really, really well done. I think, you know, the Ian Levine version aimed straight at the gay dance floor that had been so welcoming to Bananarama with Venus. So that was, you know, a direct hit with that one. And the Garage Mix by Phil Harding, another great mix by him. Certainly the reason why this song is still such a dance floor favourite and a big favourite amongst Bananarama fans.
So why didn't it work, do you think? Because it had such a great lead in from Venus. They kind of covered all their bases. What was the problem here?
It wasn't pop enough. The chorus just didn't, you know, take it all the way to the ecstatic heights that the other one did. It's very much aimed at the dance floor. And as I mentioned, you know, that's not really going to cut it on radio. Besides radio play, exposure wasn't that much of a problem for this single because it got major playlisting on MTV in America in the wake of Venus. It just got thrashed on MTV, but even that wasn't enough to get it into the top 40 there.
I wonder if it was too sexy. I mean, Venus was kind of sexy, but it was a fun song. And, you know, with the dance routine and being a cover version, it wasn't full on sexy. Whereas More Than Physical, especially with all those beefcakes in the video, was you know, it was very sexy.
Yeah, right. I think whenever you have a real mega hit, like with Venus being a number one in Australia for as long as it was, the reason it's selling that many copies is because it's getting a vast swathe of society to buy those records. And quite often that includes like little kids. And I don't think little kids who might have enjoyed watching Venus are going to have the same reaction watching More Than Physical, because as you do say, it was very sexy, very greasy, certainly popular with the boys on the dance floor, but, you know, perhaps not with the vast swathe of the audience that loved Venus.
Sorry, greasy?
Yeah, all the boys are greased up.
Oh, oiled up. Okay, right. I was just imagining like mechanics and literal grease. Anyway, I wonder, would A Trick of the Night have worked better at this point?
I think it's certainly the better song.
Agreed.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think, unfortunately, Bananarama were just paralyzed by the fear that a ballad wasn't going to work, or the record company was, because that had this really unfortunate run with mid-tempo or ballad songs in the UK. It made perfect sense that you were going to follow up a Stock Aitken and Waterman produced dance hit with another one. We do know that their A&R man at the time, Pete Tong, who went on to be a superstar DJ and a household name, he actually came to Saw with a mixtape of Chicago house songs, including people like Steve Silk Hurley, and suggested that they might want to do some house stuff with Bananarama, which was very, very early to be doing that. Imagine if Bananarama had come out with a house record straight after Venus. Well, it wasn't to be. We think that's because Bananarama themselves turned it down, because Pete Waterman was interviewed in Smash Hits in 1987, and he actually went to the extent of saying that Saw offered showing out to Bananarama and they turned it down. Now, whether that's literally true, whether they were offered the finished song, or whether they were offered a whole bunch of Chicago house sounds that eventually became showing out, I don't know. But it's interesting to imagine about what might have happened had the girls agreed to make a house record.
Now, as you mentioned, this was the first collaboration on an original song between Saw and Bananarama, and Siobhan, Sarah and Karen are credited as songwriters on their non-remake tracks with Saw. Let's hear from Mike Stock about the writing process with Bananarama. Was it any different putting together an original song with them?
Yeah, that... Well, you know, when you write songs, I got used to doing it with Matt, but, you know, you're singing soppy lyrics or something. It's very difficult to be creative if someone is just going to mock you, you know, or laugh at you. Because all I can say is whenever I write a song, I mean it, even though you might be saying, I love you, darling, with a million kisses or whatever you might say. It doesn't matter. You mean it at the time, because if you can't take it seriously, how can you expect anybody else to? And with Bananarama, they were, it was just awkward all the time, very awkward. And I didn't feel comfortable writing with them.
And was that because when you were delivering these lyrics or ideas, they reacted in a way that made you feel self-conscious?
Well, it's partly that. It just isn't productive or creative, you know. What you really want is someone to say, yeah, okay, but what about this? And give you something back that's better. But that didn't happen.
So obviously they have songwriting credits and all the stuff you've done together. So what part did they play in the songwriting process?
Well, look, the reason they get the credit is because that was the deal that we agreed. If I shake the hands and we agree on a deal, you can't change it later just because situations are different. They came to us and we thought we'd like to work with them, and their manager and record label insisted, because they had a publishing deal, and, you know, I think they had a commitment to the publisher to write so many songs a year, I guess something like that. So part of the deal to work with us was that they would get a writing credit and a share of the publishing. As to what their contribution was, well, you know, they're not musicians, so as far as I'm aware, they can't even strum a guitar. So obviously Matt and me would have to put together a drum track, a chord structure, a melody idea, and then they could chuck in some lyrics, and that's basically the way it worked.
Some lyrical contributions.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it really like that, that they would kind of laugh at what you were suggesting?
No, there's just no feedback, you know what I mean? There's no spark, there's no like, oh, we really love that, let's do this or try this or whatever. There's no sort of, yeah, it's quite hard work. I mean, certain people, just to clear the point up, certain people like Donna Summer, she'd say, I've got it, just sing me the tune, you've got play, I've got it, and then she elaborates and gives you something back, you know? So that's a pleasure.
So there we go. Mike talking about, I guess you could call it a difficult working relationship with Bananarama. And in the next episode, we are going to hear from someone else who was there at the time. It is a key PWL insider.
Hi, I'm Karen Hewitt, and I'm talking to Chartbeats about my journey with Stock Aitken and Waterman.
Yes, in the next episode, longtime PWL engineer Karen Hewitt, a fellow Aussie, will tell us all about what it was like working at the Hit Factory and what those songwriting sessions between Stock Aitken and Waterman and Bananarama were like for someone watching on. Now, as well as discussing Bananarama, she's going to talk about Matt's favourite topic, Kakko. Dead or Alive. Karen was involved in the making of Dead or Alive's second album with Saw, a third overall, Mad, Bad and Dangerous to Know. And in the next episode, we have the lead single from that, Brand New Lover, to discuss, as well as the next batch of Saw produced songs. So Karen will be joining us for that. Excited, Matt? I can feel it from here.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of my favorite Saw songs of all time. You'll find out just how much I love it in the next episode.
No.
Yes, yes. And it also comprises the next major step into the US market foresaw. So it's definitely an episode you're going to want to listen to.
That's right. Now, if the 2-week wait between episodes is too much to bear, why not subscribe to our bonus material? For this episode, we'll share more of our interview with Phil Fearon, and as I said, the full Steve Grant interview. Head to chartbeats.com.au/saw for all the details. Matt, anything to say before we head off?
Just that thank you very, very, very much for all your kind messages about the podcast. Please keep them coming. We love hearing them. And thank you very much for all your support. It's really wonderful.
Indeed. Agreed. Until next time. Bye.
Bye.